Aikatra Podcast Conversations for the Curious Essential Knowledge, Simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Aikatra AI. Welcome to the deep dive. Today, we're tackling one of history's most, let's say, misrepresented figures.
Yeah.
The Viking. Forget that cartoon image, you know, like bloodthirsty guy in a horned helmet, which, by the way, completely made up. Never happened.
Total myth, yeah.
Yeah.
Invented much, much later.
Exactly. So we're going to peel back all that fiction and get down to the real evidence, the archaeology. And our guide for this is the incredible work of Julian Richards.
Right. That's really our mission today, to kind of dismantle that whole stereotype. Because look, the traditional story, the history we often get, it was mostly written down by Christian monks.
Who were, understandably, not exactly fans.
Understandably terrified, yes. And, you know, deeply biased because of that. So by focusing instead on the material culture, what they left behind, Richards paints this picture of a society that was powerful, yes, but also adaptable, complex, and frankly, global. There were skilled traders and governors, not just raiders.
And this isn't just like academic nitpicking, is it? Getting the Vikings right actually matters. Understanding their real impact, these huge trade networks they built, the maritime tech, their political innovations.
Yeah, it gives us a whole new perspective on how medieval Europe actually developed. And you can even see echoes in like modern global economies. They weren't just about tearing things down. They were building blocks for this interconnected world we have now.
Okay, so who is our guide through this? Julian Richards.
Right. So Julian Richards, he's a top archaeological historian, lectures at the University of York. But the really key thing, I think, is his commitment to fieldwork. He's not just someone reading old texts in a library.
No, he's been out there, hasn't he? For decades.
Oh, yeah. Over 30 years directing major digs, Britain, Scandinavia. He's got the hands-on experience, boots on the ground, literally.
And that's what makes his perspective and his book feel so, I don't know, solid, authoritative. He can kind of sidestep those potentially unreliable written accounts.
Exactly. Instead of just focusing on, you know, what the victims said happened to them, Richards is looking at the evidence for how the Vikings actually lived, how their society functioned.
So what's so different about his method? He focuses on archaeology, the physical stuff.
Yeah, and that's the fascinating part. He really prioritizes the silent testimony of the things they left behind. So looking at how settlements were laid out, how their ships were built, which is huge, the kinds of things they buried with their dead, and maybe most importantly, these massive hoards of silver.
Right, the silver hoards. We'll get to those.
Yeah. All these things, they tell a much more nuanced, objective story than, you know, a chronicle written by someone who just got raided.
Okay, so when he started really focusing on that physical evidence, what was like a key discovery, something that really challenged those old stories?
Well, a great example is his work at the Viking Great Army's winter camp at Torksey.
Okay.
The sheer scale of that site, I mean, it showed these weren't just small bands of hit-and-run raiders. This was a huge, mobile, incredibly organized community. They were settling in for the winter, negotiating, holding territory.
Wow. So like a moving town almost.
Basically, yeah.
Yeah.
And that complexity, it's physically proven by the archaeology. It's not just guesswork based on biased texts.
Right. So, okay, zooming out then to the book itself, Richards is basically giving us a total rethink, a reconstruction of Norse society from when they first pop up in the 8th century.
Right through to the 11th century when they're sort of integrating more into Christian Europe, yeah.
And it's not just Scandinavia and Britain, is it? The scope is huge.
Oh, it's massive. Truly panoramic. You've got Scandinavia and Britain, obviously, but then it stretches east all the way across the rivers of Russia, where the Rus, who were Norse, basically founded Kievan Rus.
Wow.
Down to the Byzantine Empire, interactions with the Islamic world, hence the silver, and then all the way west across the Atlantic to Vinland, North America.
It's just, the connectivity is staggering. And the book's core argument, it seems, isn't just about conquest, but about their adaptability.
Exactly. That's the defining trait Richards highlights. Not bloodlust, but this incredible, almost pragmatic flexibility. They weren't stuck in one way of doing things. They constantly tweaked their institutions, their laws, their economic strategies.
Based on what worked, wherever they were.
Precisely. Based entirely on what was succeeding in that specific environment.
It
changed the places they went, sure. But they also changed themselves based on what worked best. Farming, trading, fighting, whatever the situation called for.
Okay, let's dig into that a bit. Starting with the tech that made it all possible. The ships. If the Vikings reshaped their world, the longship was the tool, right? What made it so revolutionary?
Well, the archaeology, finds like the Skuldalev ships or the Gokstad ship, they show us this incredible design. The key was the clinker-built hull.
Meaning?
Overlapping planks. It made the ship surprisingly flexible, able to sort of ride with the waves in the rough North Atlantic rather than just crashing through them. Super resilient. But the real game changer, strategically, the incredibly shallow draft.
Ah, so they didn't need deep harbors.
Exactly. They could sail across the open ocean, handle serious waves, and then just turn right up a river, even a really shallow one.
And sail way inland.
Way inland, bypassing all the coastal forts and defenses everyone else relied on. It gave them this unprecedented mobility. Surprise factor. The rest of Europe just couldn't really counter it effectively.
I love that idea you mentioned from Richards that the ship wasn't just a boat, it was like a floating embassy.
Yeah, carrying power, ideas, status. Not just warriors. Which leads perfectly into the whole economic picture.
Right, the raider and trader thing, not just one or the other.
Exactly. Richards really pushes back against that simple binary. Raiding and trading weren't separate boxes. They were tools in the same toolkit. It was all about acquiring wealth and status, and they used whichever method or combination of methods worked best at the time.
So it was fluid, opportunistic.
Totally opportunistic. Like, if negotiations over trade broke down, okay, maybe the swords came out. If an area was too well defended to raid effectively, fine, let's set up a market and trade instead. It was a spectrum.
Okay, but hold on. We're talking Arab silver, Byzantine silk. How does that fit with the barbarian image? Norsemen and Arabs doing business deals.
Well, the evidence is just overwhelming, especially when you look at the eastern the river routes through modern-day Russia and Ukraine, controlled by the Norse Rus. Mm-hmm. They were paddling down these rivers, trading northern goods, think furs, amber, and yes, slaves, all the way to the Caspian Sea, to Byzantium. And what did they bring back? Silks, luxury goods, but crucially, tons and tons of Arab silver coins, dirhams.
And we find these coins back in Scandinavia.
In huge hoards, buried all over Scandinavia. It's undeniable proof of this vast trading network. It shows that economic sophistication was central. They weren't just setting up temporary camps. They were founding major urban centers. Think Jorvik, that's modern York in England, or Dublin in Ireland.
And these places weren't just fortresses.
No, not primarily. Jorvik, based on the archaeology, was a bustling cosmopolitan hub. Full of craftspeople making jewelry, trading goods from all over the known world. International exchange. That's the real Viking success story as much as the raiding.
Okay, beyond the markets and the silver, maybe the most surprising thing is their political structure. We think Vikings, we think strongman kings, right? But then there are these thing assemblies. What were they?
They were pretty remarkable, actually. A real political innovation for the time. The thing was basically a regional assembly. All the free landowners, not just the rich nobles, would gather.
To do what?
To debate laws, settle legal disputes, make collective decisions for the community. Richards really emphasizes this point. It might be one of humanity's earliest large-scale experiments in something like representative government.
Wow. So, like, if a local chieftain or even a king got too pushy, people could actually challenge him in this assembly. It wasn't just top-down rule.
Pretty much. It was built much more on consensus, on hashing things out collectively rather than just obeying royal commands.
Yeah.
Prioritized negotiation and agreement.
That's fascinating.
And that same sort of pragmatism, valuing contribution, seems to extend to gender roles too. Viking women, particularly if you look at the Icelandic laws, which are well preserved, had significantly more rights than most women in medieval Europe at the time.
Like what kind of rights?
Well, the right to own and inherit property in their own name. The right to conduct business. And crucially, the right to initiate divorce.
Divorce? In the early medieval period, that's huge.
It really is. And it speaks to a society that, maybe out of pragmatism, valued competence and contribution. Think about Queen Alv the Deep-Minded.
Okay, tell me about her.
Well, after her husband and son were killed, she didn't just fade away. She organized, financed, and personally led a major expedition to settle Iceland. Chartered ships, freed slaves, granted them land. She wasn't just some anomaly. She was acting as a leader within a system that allowed for female agency and power based on capability.
That pragmatism again. It sounds like it must have bled into their religion, too. They didn't seem rigidly dogmatic.
No, not at all. Richards talks a lot about their religious syncretism, basically, mixing beliefs. They often didn't see a contradiction in, say, honoring Thor and Christ, especially if dealing with Christian traders or rulers offered practical advantages.
So hedging their bets spiritually?
Partly, yeah. But also maybe showing a kind of respect or diplomacy. Archaeologically, you find things like pendants that combine a Christian cross with Thor's hammer. They were flexible, adaptable in their spirituality, too.
And you see that blending in their art as well, right? It wasn't just crude carving.
Far from it. Viking art is incredibly intricate, and it pulls in influences from everywhere they traveled. You see Celtic knotwork patterns, motifs that echo Byzantine designs, even geometric patterns that hint at Islamic art. But they synthesized it all into something uniquely Norse.
Which really reinforces that final big idea from Richards.
Yeah, that the Vikings weren't really a single people or ethnicity in the way we think of it now. It was more like a way of life, a cultural and economic system focused on mobility, opportunity, pragmatism, and anyone potentially could adopt it.
Okay, so this archaeological deep dive gives us a totally different picture. What are the big lessons we can take away from Richard's work today?
Well, the first one is fundamental, isn't it? It's about the relevance of source material.
Right. Questioning who wrote the history.
Exactly. The traditional Viking story was written by their victims. Archaeology provides that crucial, objective counter-narrative. So the lesson for us is always be critical. Always look for the single story, as Chimamanda Adichie calls it, and try to find other evidence. Material evidence often doesn't lie.
That's a great point. Okay, what else?
Second big theme, adaptive flexibility. Their success wasn't just brute force. It was this incredible ability to pivot, switch from raiding to farming to trading, change religious customs if it helped them integrate or do business.
So don't be too rigid.
Right. If a strategy isn't working, whether it's in business or life, don't just stick to it out of stubbornness or ideology. Be willing to adapt to try something new based on the reality of the situation. That's very Viking, in a way.
It definitely applies today. The world changes so fast. Being flexible, opportunistic in a good way, ready to seize chances, that seems way more valuable than just sticking to some rigid plan.
Absolutely. And the third takeaway connects to how they organize themselves, their organizational structure.
You mean like the thing assemblies and the role of women?
Yeah. It points towards a system that valued merit and contribution, maybe more than strict hierarchy or inherited status. The thing involved collective decision-making. Women had significant rights and could achieve high status based on capability, like Queen Aud.
So modern organizations could learn from that, valuing competence over just position or gender.
I think so. Building systems where individual ability and contribution are really recognized and rewarded, regardless of where someone sits on the org chart or, you know, traditional roles.
Okay, the book clearly makes a powerful case. Richards uses archaeology to reshape our view. Are there some core ideas, maybe not exact quotes, but key concepts that really stick with you?
Definitely. Even if not direct quotes, Richards crystallizes some big ideas. One is about the ships that they weren't just transport, but something more like their ships were floating embassies carrying not just people, but ideas, technologies, and the very possibility of new ways of living and trading. It reframes the technology culturally.
I like that. What about the politics? The thing.
Yeah, you could capture its significance like this. The thing assemblies were maybe humanity's earliest large-scale experiments in checking centralized power, where free people met not just to obey, but to argue, negotiate, and shape their future by consensus. It gives them credit for some really sophisticated political thinking.
Okay. And one more, maybe summing up the whole archaeological approach.
How about this? The buried objects, the settlement layouts, the sheer stuff they left behind, reveals a society far more intricate and sophisticated than the hostile chronicles ever admitted, a world where women led expeditions, artisans blended global styles into masterpieces, and law flowed from collective agreement. It highlights the power of the material evidence.
Those are powerful summaries. So how do we apply this Viking insight, this revised view, to our lives now? Let's talk real life applications, leadership. Strategy.
Well, take their exploration strategy. Yeah. The Vinland voyages are a good example. They did just send thousands of people blindly across the Atlantic.
Right. Leif Erikson went first, didn't he? Small group.
Exactly. Small advance parties. Test the waters, assess the opportunities, gauge the risks before committing huge resources or populations. That's classic risk management. Any business entering a new market could learn from that. Send out probes, do pilot projects, be flexible, be ready to pull back if it's not working. Don't bet the farm on day one.
That makes sense. What about global business? They're operating across huge cultural divides.
And they succeeded often by being culturally fluent, didn't they? They formed partnerships. They learned local customs, sometimes even adopted local gods or symbols. They were flexible in how they operated in different places, even while maintaining a core Norse identity. That's a pretty good model for a multinational company today, isn't it? balancing global strategy with local adaptation.
It really is. And internally, within an organization.
Think about conflict resolution. The Think system, from what we can tell, often focused on finding ways to compensate victims and restore social harmony rather than just pure punishment or retribution, negotiating a settlement, making things right.
Restorative justice, kind of.
Yeah, something like that, which feels very relevant for, say, workplace disputes today.
Yeah.
Focusing on repairing relationships and finding solutions, not just assigning blame.
Okay, wrapping up. What was the most surprising thing for you in revisiting the Vikings through this lens? Or what did you love most?
For me, honestly, it's the final nail in the coffin for the horned helmet. Good riddance. But seriously, it's the sheer scale of their interconnectedness. The fact that you find Arab silver, Byzantine silks, even hints of North American goods back in Scandinavia. It just blows away that image of isolated barbarians. They were plugged into the world.
Yeah, that global reach is stunning. For me, I think the most lasting insight is that core principle of adaptive flexibility. It's how they managed to combine a really strong sense of cultural identity being Norse with this incredible openness to learning, changing, and integrating new ideas or technologies if they worked.
Pragmatism over dogma. Exactly. Yeah. And that's the challenge for us, maybe. To look at our own assumptions, how we run things, how we interact, how we lead, and ask, are we being flexible? Are we adapting based on results? Or are we stuck in old ways just because they're familiar? The Vikings challenge us to be smarter about that.
A fantastic point to end on. Thinking about how adaptable we really are. See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Akatra Foundation.